Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Welcome to Reconstruction, the podcast brought to you by the Construction Index. I'm David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and with me as ever to discuss this week's industry news and hopefully shed some light on current issues is Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news service.
Hello. Hello, David, and hello, everyone who's listening. It's quite an exciting week. It's July already. Can you believe that?
Yes, indeed. Yes, we should have said Wednesday, the 1st of July.
Indeed. April, May and June have just disappeared in a lockdown meltdown. But the pubs are opening this weekend. Would you be going on Saturday?
No, I won't, actually. I'm going to steer clear until the melee has subsided. I think that it'll probably be mayhem, actually, in my local pub. So I'm going to steer clear of it. What about you?
I will certainly walk past, and I might find myself, if it's not too awkward, I might find myself getting pulled into the garden. I have my dog is trained not to walk past pubs. He always sort of tugs the lead and says, come on, let's go in. That's my story.
Anyway. Oh, right. Well, my local pub has had to put up big notices outside throughout the lockdown saying the pub is not open, which astonishes me, actually, because I would have thought everybody going past the pub would have known that pubs weren't open. But clearly, they've still had people pitching up and expecting a drink. But they will be open on Saturday, but I'm not going. Not just yet.
Well, I'll check back on your withholding powers in the 2 weeks' time and we talk again then. See whether you've managed to keep yourself away.
Yeah. Well, I've got a challenge for you today, Phil, actually. I thought it'd be interesting to see if we could talk about, or if we could do something today that currently no other media commentators seem able to do. And that's to speak for at least 30 minutes without using the terms unprecedented or new normal. every single news bulletin seems to be punctuated with these phrases. I'm getting heartily sick of it. So I don't think that we actually do keep mentioning these terms, but they do tend to slip into conversation all the time now. So I'm going to steer well clear. Anyway, this week's news, or this past fortnight's news, what's been going on, Phil?
Well, construction industry is all over the front pages past couple of days. The big story I think we should talk about today. Build, build, build. The New Deal. Project speed. Boris Johnson in hard hat and high-vis jackets on construction sites. I've been inundated with emails from all corners of the construction industry saying, this is great news. This is fantastic. We're getting Britain building. Great. Hurrah. And not many people have pointed out that actually the statement Boris Johnson made yesterday on all this new building work that is going to unleash on the construction industry is exactly the same work that was announced on the 11th of March by Rishi Sunak the Chancellor in the budget statement. So it's only new. And Boris Johnson could have said a lot more. I mean, for example, we're supposed to be excited about £100 million on the road network is going to be spent. You think, fantastic, £100 million. Well, actually, the Chancellor announced that the road budget for the next five-year road investment strategy, £27 billion over 5 years. So we should be spending about, roughly speaking, £5 or £6 billion on the road network this year. So £100 million is not really something to jump up and down.
It doesn't go very far in a road project, does it? £100 million.
And the £5 billion is the total package that Johnson was trumpeting about what the big infrastructure push, £5 billion of work, hospitals, schools, roads, and more. But actually, if we think back to the budget in March, that was £640 billion over 5 years in roads, rail, communication, schools, hospitals, power networks. You know, there's capital spending on infrastructure and buildings. £640 billion over 5 years, which, you know, roughly speaking, equals £125 billion a year or something. So if Johnson's telling us to get excited about this £5 billion, what happened to the other 120 billion, which had been supposed to be happening this year?
So, I suppose 5 billion sounds like a lot of money to anybody, really, but,
in public spending speak, it's not.
No.
It's great that we're, it's much better to be talking about building stuff than not talking about building stuff or talking about not building stuff. But it is classic political rah-rah-rah cheerleading. And that's, let's face it, that's Boris Johnson's great talent is a cheerleader and a flag waver.
Yeah. I think it's also clearly an exercise in trying to sound sort of statesmanlike, because I mean he himself described his announcement as positively Rooseveltian. You know, you mentioned the New Deal. Of course, the New Deal, Roosevelt's New Deal back in 1930 was to, in response to the Great Depression, and it was to spend loads of government money on public projects to get the American economy going again. So he's really talking it up in a fairly substantial way here. He said the idea was to build homes, fix the NHS and tackle the skills crisis, mend the indefensible gap in opportunity and productivity. I mean, he used such sort of, basically he was pressing all the right buttons, wasn't he? These are all the things that people have been worried about for years, not just recently.
Yes, there's nothing new in terms of the agenda. Every government wants to fix things and build things and make things better. No one's ever come into power by saying we're going to not build anything and not do anything. And what I've come to realise about Boris Johnson, and it was the reference to Roosevelt that got it. I mean, Roosevelt is one of those figures in American politics that is universally revered and loved, or at least appears to be. That what it is about Boris Johnson is, and this is not unusual for politicians, he's a people pleaser. All he wants to do is people please, and this is why he got into a tangle over the wretched Garden Bridge. The Garden Bridge when he was London mayor made absolutely no sense. It wasn't a transport project. It wasn't a piece of infrastructure. It wasn't being built because anyone wanted to cross the river at that particular point. It was simply a lot of people around and got enthusiastic and said, oh, this would be nice. This will make people happy. Yeah. And he thought it would be a people-pleasing thing. And everything he does seems to be motivated by the desire to people-please, including getting stuck on zip wires and stunts like that. I don't know if it's a strength or a weakness in a politician. And I think that's what yesterday is all about. He's trying to engender some confidence in the economy and in the country generally, that we're going to get things going and get things moving. And we said before, it will take public sector money to get the construction industry back moving again, because I think the private sector is going to be a tad shy.
Yes, absolutely. They're going to sort of be a bit like me in the pubs. They're going to see what happens before they commit
themselves.
Yeah, but you're absolutely right, because I received loads of emails yesterday from industry bodies and contractors and various other interested parties about generally speaking, they were saying what a wonderful announcement this was, and it stimulated confidence and all the rest of it. I mean, there were a few who had reservations, but generally speaking, it was a positive response, and it was a very sort of concerted response as well. Loads of people felt that they had to have their two penneth and say something about it and how wonderful it was going to be and how they were right behind him and all the rest of it. But as you say, it was news but not news, really, because we already knew what was coming.
Classic re-announcement, like you get at party conference speeches every year. It's a big platform occasion. They have to announce big things. And most of the time, they're just re-announcing things that they've announced 72 times already.
I mean, one of the few sort of critics I noticed was the National... Is it the UK Green Building Council, which rather predictably said that, we don't want build, build, build. You want build better, wasn't it? I can't remember what the phrase was that they used, but they were... They've been pushing, obviously, for more environmental policies or to have green policies dictating industry policy and that kind of thing. So they were saying, what do they say, that it makes no reference to energy efficiency. And this is the most urgent of all infrastructure priorities. And they said that it could also generate lots of jobs. But I suspect that they were probably missing the point, because I think everybody's priority at the moment is just to get the economy back up and running. And, you know, niceties like placing an emphasis on environmental considerations possibly is a luxury we can't afford at the moment.
I don't think the environmental agenda has in any way been diminished by either the COVID lockdown crisis and or yesterday's announcement or any of these things. It was just that's the fine detail that wasn't part of the headline. Part of the headline is we're going to build these things, we're going to do these things.
Yes.
But of course they're going to use off-site construction and you know, environmentally friendly materials as far as possible, and London ultra-low emission zone and all of that is still in place. And
yeah,
we're not suddenly going back to using, you know, stage three, stage two construction machinery, which is, you know, dirtier than the latest generation stuff.
Yeah.
So I think we're still moving forward on that. What wasn't new, because we know there's this planning paper due out, it's coming out this month at some stage, but what was given a little bit more flesh on the bones in yesterday's speech by Boris Johnson, which concerns me and does concern some of the environmental lobby, I know, is the reform of the planning system.
Oh, yes.
There's always been a strong urge. It almost seems like a truism to say that the planning system's broken. There's too much red tape and we need to cut through red tape. And yet, it seems to me when I look around near where I live, where green fields have been turned into housing estates at the rate of knots, that it seems too easy to get rid of countryside.
Yeah.
And it's too hard for neighbourhoods to say, hang on a minute, we actually, you know, we know we need housing, but suddenly, what used to be a 5-minute journey now takes 25 minutes to get anywhere, and there are no extra buses or cycle lanes to you know, do it any other way. I think the democracy in the planning system, and people talk about red tape, but it's not red tape. It's most of it. It's good old fashioned democracy and accountability, and letting people have their say. And most planning applications go through. There aren't many planning applications that fail. So if anything, I think the planning system is too easy, not too hard. I'm in the other camp, and maybe, as I say, I'm sensitive because I'm in an area which is in Kent, which is rife with new build development everywhere.
It's the same down here in Devon. It's exactly the same. And most of the developments are on greenfield sites. I mean, there are plenty of brownfield sites here which are ripe for redevelopment, and admittedly, in my local town, there is a large redevelopment of a brownfield site, which includes a reclamation of a sort of a flood area as well, which is all very good, but there's a huge amount of greenfield development happening here as well, and I'm sure that's the same all over the country. And if you speak to people in the street, or dare I say in the pub, most of them deplore it, and yet it's still happening, so somebody's certainly in favour. I thought, though, that the relaxation of the planning regulations which Boris Johnson referred to were largely due to change of use rather than greenfield.
That's what he mentioned yesterday, but the further planning reforms are coming, being published in the next few weeks. But yes, he talked about the change of use. I mean, do you remember, I don't know how long ago it was, it wasn't very long ago, where you could you're allowed to turn office buildings into apartments.
That's
into
right,
flats.
Yeah.
And many people thought, This is a great idea. Plenty of office blocks that can be turned to, you know, badly needed housing in town centres and so on. But it's not worked out that way. Actually, the office blocks that have been turned to housing, from the reports that I've read of it and the studies I've read, suggest it's been pretty rubbish, grotty housing.
Yeah.
It's almost the new Rackmanism, a lot of it. I mean, it's grotty, and
there's no reason why it should be like that, of course.
Well, they tend not to be buildings designed for living in. It tends to be the grottiest office blocks which are empty because they're grotty.
Yeah.
And so they just put in a few beds and bathrooms, pods or whatever, and think, there you go, live in that. And there's no... Well, I would like to see, before we start talking about turning the Arndale Centre or Lakeside Thurrock into housing, all the shopping centres or the commercial buildings that are going to be changed into housing, I would like to see something put in place to avoid the problems that we've had with office blocks being changed into housing. I don't have particular suggestions for that, but I think it needs addressing.
Well, they'd better do it quickly as well, because, I mean, the big shopping centre landlord went into receivership this week, didn't
it? Exactly that, yes.
So we might have quite a lot of out-of-town shopping centres in urgent need of redevelopment for some other purpose. And what with everybody now working from home, there must be plenty of commercial offices which are going to remain empty once people get back up to work. So I don't know. Maybe not housing, maybe something else. I don't know.
Which failed department store would you like to move into? I'm going for Toys R Us.
I hadn't thought about that, actually. Yeah, Toys R Us would probably be okay.
Benson's for Beds is, and that's been bought back, but Harvey's is a furniture shop. So you come with ready furniture if you move into a Harvey's.
Well, that's a good idea, yeah. You sleep in a different bed every night. But, Boris's build agenda is,
We don't, but
so
well,
much
we,
hot air. We'll see.
We're moderately cynical, I think. We can put ourselves down for on that one.
So moving on, Phil, what else has been happening to... what else has caught your eye?
Well, there's... Construction Industry Training Board is never out of the news. It's one of those organisations that is like a smelly old dog that we love and we kick it at the same time. I'm not advocating kicking dogs, folks, but it does seem to always get abuse from all sorts of quarters, and everyone says it needs to improve, and no sooner is it halfway through one set of change than people say, oh, it needs to change again or do something different.
Yeah.
But we need the Construction Industry Training Board because the construction industry is so fragmented. I mean, it is a bit of a socialist construct, centralising the industry's training effort in that way, but the big companies don't employ the jobbing builders, and the little companies haven't got the resources to have structured industry planned training that is required. And so in the olden days, Construction Industry Training Board delivered training. Now, by and large, I mean, I think it spends far too much time lobbying and doing, you know, government relations type of stuff, but its main purpose is to take money off contractors, take the levy, which all construction companies pay, and redistribute it to best effect. Now, no one's going to ever agree on what best effect means. There's always going to be arguments about, you know, whether it's better to give more to training scheme A or training scheme B, and they're it used to be training very much at the blue collar end, and now I think, well, actually, no, we need, you know, our managers need to be able to go to Harvard Business School and do management training and that sort of stuff, or even soft skills and time management. And so CITB money does go to professional services type of training as well. And I'm not sure that's I'd rather see it much more doing, you know, training crane drivers and bricklayers and so forth, and carpenters and plumbers.
Well, once upon a time, it did the lot, didn't it? Not so long ago. I mean, they had Bertram Newton up in Norfolk, that great big training centre, and they administered the levy, they issued grants, they trained people up, they awarded qualifications, and really all they do is the admin now. I mean, the qualifications aren't, they don't issue qualifications anymore, do they?
No. But why we're talking about it today is because every 2 years, every 4 years, every periodically, under the legislation that gives the Construction Industry Training Board power to raise the levy, it's a bit like the BBC licence fee. The BBC's got to do certain things for its charter, and the CITB charter, if you like. It's got to consult formally with the construction industry about the levy process, and do we all still think it's a good idea, folks? And the construction industry comes back and says, yep, we approve, keep going. And then it goes to government and says, yep, we still have our mandate to exist. It's called the consensus process, where it seeks consensus from the industry to keep going. And it's what gives it its entire democratic legitimacy. It's a bit like if we didn't have elections in this country and the government just declared itself the government. It may still have power, but it wouldn't really have any legitimacy and democratic accountability. So the consensus process is dull sounding, but intrinsically and inherently important to the functioning of the Constructionist Training Board. It's supposed
how
to be
does
getting...
it work, Phil? Do you know? Do you know how it works?
The process.
The consensus process.
Not in fine detail, but broadly speaking, it is a formal consultation process with, I think it's through trade associations and all, you know, any and all of them that are out
right,
there.
Right, yeah.
And the trade associations then, you know, do their own consultation with their members. I think
with
it's done
members,
on that
right.
basis. I don't think they do it directly to
right,
builders,
okay.
Johnny Builders or us. And it was supposed to happen, it was due to happen this summer, the consensus process. It should have probably started already by now. In March, when this whole lockdown thing happened, the Constructionist Training Board suspended the levy. They stopped collecting the levy payments from companies to help them out doing its bit, which is a grand and good thing. And then they're continuing that now until I think September. The levy suspension
yeah.
is going on for. But as part of this sort of hiatus in processes, they've also decided, or they've got permission from the Department for Education, which is the government body that sponsors the CITB or that the CITB reports to. They've got approval that they're going to not do the consensus process this year or even next year. And they're going to keep the levy going in 2021 and into the 2022-23 financial year without having the formal consent of industry. And most people...
That's what controversial.
Well, most people are kind of going, you know, Mark Reynolds, who's the boss of Mace, who heads the skills group on the Construction Leadership Council and is therefore the unelected, appointed by ministers, man who has the big voice on these things. He says CITB has got it absolutely right. He's got no problem with suspension of this democratic process. It's an emergency, folks. Let's get on with it. We need to, you know, get on with recovery and not worry about these sort of democratic things. I'm slightly putting words in his mouth. Apologies, Mark Reynolds, but that seems to me the thrust of what you're saying. But the only person I've heard coming out with a slightly hold on a minute kind of line is the national chair of the National Federation of Builders. The National Federation of Builders is an organisation I don't know terribly well. They haven't got that high a profile, but on more and more topics to me, they seem to be the voice of sense. Nick Sangwin, the national chair, he's saying that we warmly welcome the temporary cut in the levy, and it's going to be very helpful. And it does mean that it is a cut in the levy. It's not like you have to pay it back later. They were actually paying less money for the levy in the next couple of years. And he says, you know, that's lovely, and thank you for that. But, and I quote him here, we cannot have a situation whereby the CITB avoids accountability at the most crucial time in our industry's fragile recovery. 2 years is too long to wait, and we will be making that representation to the government. And I think he's got a point. I mean, it's too easy to declare it's a national emergency, swipe away all powers. I think it's bad enough with lockdown telling people they couldn't go to the beach or walk their dog on the moors because you know, coronavirus. But at least that was had footing in health. The CITB's justification for suspending the consensus process is based on the economy. So I don't know that it has a choice. I think it would be difficult, but again, as I say, CITB, it can't do right for doing wrong, or wrong for doing right, or however you want to phrase it.
Who owns the CITB, Phil?
I think the industry does. I don't think...
God, what, through the levy?
Yes, I think so. It's like all these charities. Charities aren't owned, are they? It is a charity. Which is in another sense why I stick up with the CITB, because there are other training organisations which appear to be similar to CITB, which are actually privately owned, owned companies, you know, which make a profit. And I know the CITB don't have the construction skills certification scheme, the card skills, card schemes anymore under their ownership or ambit. But there are other card schemes which people want to push for instead of CPCS or CSCS, the two plants and skills. But the alternative ones are privately owned. And I think I need to be naturally a little bit more, well, I need to be aware that different rules apply for private organisations. who are in it for the money rather than in it for the public good. And the CITB is only in it for the public good. It's in it for no other reason. And for that, I think we, you know, perhaps should give it some slack and some gratitude even. But you're a bit cynical about CITB there. You're not. You think it's a socialist
construct. I don't know. Whenever I've written about training, I've always felt that I never got really much information out of the CITB. I don't know. I think in the past, certainly their sort of marketing and publicity operation has been fairly clunky and not particularly proactive. In terms of the way it operates, well, you know, I feel I don't really know as much as I should know about the CITB. I know it's undergone huge changes in the last few years, but it has always been a bit of an Aunt Sally. It's always come in for criticism.
That's the term I was looking for when I talked about smelly old Labrador. Aunt Sally, much better.
I think the fact that, as you say, it's got this statutory power to collect the levy. And you made that comparison with the BBC licence fee, and I think that's probably a very apposite comparison, because the BBC is always coming under criticism, and it's really in a sticky position, really, because I don't think there's a consultation process with the licence payers by the BBC, but they've got their board of governors, haven't they? And it's very highly regulated, and they do review the BBC licence fee on a regular basis. But it's a constant need to justify, not justify your existence, but certainly justify your ability to demand money from people, especially when, you know, as a public service broadcaster, for example, the BBC has this public service remit, rather like the CITB does. But, you know, if something goes wrong, or if the BBC behaves in a way which is seen to be reprehensible, even in a very minor way, people immediately say, we pay our licence fee, you know, and I'm not going to... Charles Moore, the former editor of the Daily Telegraph and regular columnist with The Spectator and other publications, very proudly declares that he refuses to pay his licence fee. I don't know whether he still refuses.
Oh, send him
he
to
certainly
jail.
Did for a while.
That's well, exactly. He's,
well, yes, I mean, there he is. He sort of goads the BBC and says, well, come and get me, you know. I'm making a moral stance here, taking a moral stance, and I'm not going to pay my licence fee. Well, and I think that the same sort of attitude prevails in the construction industry with regard to the CITB. People say, we're paying for this, you know, and you're not coming up to scratch. And so the customer's always right. So the CITB has to try and justify its role all the time.
Well, I'm a fan of the BBC as well. And I think,
even for
listening to, I mean, you don't need a license to listen to the radio, but I would pay it just to have access to the BBC radio stations that I listen to.
Yeah. Yes. Well, yes, I'm inclined to agree with you there. So, and I'm sure there are people out in the construction industry who feel exactly the same about CITB. As you say, we do need it. It might not be perfect and it might deserve criticism, but we need it. So let's hope that it can sort itself out and that things will continue.
Well, we always wanted to do more for less, and like everyone wants all these organisations. So it has its budgets cut and suddenly, you know, weaknesses appear and people are surprised. You know, it's not, if it hasn't got the money it used to have, you know, it can't be making EastEnders 7 days a week.
I think the next topic on our agenda, Phil, is a topic very close to your heart, because you've written about it, spoken about it, and have strong opinions about it. And that's the general topic being the drift of construction firms into the services sector, facilities management and such like. And there's been an interesting development this week, hasn't there, with one of the biggest proponents of this trend.
This is the business story of the week, I think. Interserve is selling its facilities management business to Mitie, which is probably the most significant development in this sector since the fall of Carillion 2 years ago.
Mm.
Yes, you're right. I've always been, I don't know, fascinated, but I've always been concerned about contractors, construction companies drifting opportunistically or even galloping opportunistically into areas they know nothing about, just because you can build a power station or a hospital doesn't suddenly mean that you should be doing transporting prisoners or running security for systems for the Crown Courts or whatever. There are at least two ways where this drift of construction companies into facilities management happened. One is the development in the 1990s, I guess, of a form of contract called design, build, finance and operate, whereby a contracting consortium would be required to think of Dartford Hospital was an early one. Government get a PFI job where they say, right, not only are you going to design and build this hospital, but you're going to be responsible for running it, looking after it for 20, 30 years or whatever. That way we know that any building defects which will emerge, and because these building defects tend not to emerge immediately, they tend to take time to appear, any building defects
are going to be the builder's problem.
You've got to deal with them. And this is a great way of transferring risk. It made absolute sense. Transfer the risk back onto the party that knows best how to deal with it. And with a bridge, for example, like the Dartford Bridge that Trafalgar House built around 1990, fantastic and perfect. Trafalgar House collected the tolls, or whoever came after them collected the tolls, maintained the bridge. All was well. The bridge was built on time and budget. Great project. Hospitals is slightly different, because we're not just talking about the fabric of the building. We're talking the operating of the building also extends to varying degrees of soft services, but certainly all the janitorial stuff.
Yeah.
And then this got the construction companies again to school buildings and all the way through to school meals. I mean, Carillion was doing school dinners. Why you want someone who's expert in mixing concrete, mixing your mashed potatoes suddenly, I don't know. But that's how it all happened. So there's a drift down that side. But it also happened because a lot of these formerly state-run, local authority-run public services were contracted out and privatised. And contractors saw themselves, from the get-go in construction right down to the building of, Stonehenge and the Pyramids. What construction has been doing has been marshalling large groups of people and pointing them in a certain direction and getting them to do things in concert, which is, whether that's building something or cleaning a hospital or running school kitchens, they could argue there are parallels. Anyway, what we then had is people like Tarmac becoming Carillion and Tilbury Douglas, as it became, becoming Interserve around the turn of the millennium. And instead of being construction companies on the construction listings of the stock exchange, they joined support services. And on both Carillion and Interserve, support services became much bigger part of their work than construction. The companies increasingly were run by people who weren't construction people. That's not quite.
And I think the incentive though for companies like that, was it to sort of move out of a high risk area like construction and into something which is a little bit more dependent and also more investable, maybe would perform better on the public stock exchange.
Much more. This is all about financial investors, much more attractive to them. It doesn't have the high risk. It doesn't have the cycles. It doesn't have the guaranteed public sector revenue stream. It looked like an absolute banker. It looked like money for old rope. And it's, to a certain extent, it was money for old rope. The business models is predicated on looking forward down the line to what the costs were going to be and being predictable. Then the minimum wage came in. And suddenly their biggest cost, which is their people, I can't remember how much the minimum wage added on, but the minimum wage has gone up since it first came in as well. But the minimum wage suddenly eroded the profits of a lot of these support services projects. And we had the age of austerity and there's lots of public sector cuts. And suddenly facilities management didn't look quite so good. And that wasn't the reason for Carillion's collapse, but it didn't help them. But all the support services companies have had problems in recent years, and there had to be some. In fact, Interserve went into administration itself last year, and the sale of... It was kind of thought at the time that it might have been the construction business that would be sold. They tried to sell RMD Quickform, their formwork
scaffolding
business. They put that on the market. That's a 200 million turnover business. but it's very profitable. It's the most profitable bit of the company, that. And no one was offering them as much money as they realised it was worth to them keeping it. So they kept IMD Quickform. And now they've got rid of the bulk of, there's still some little bits and pieces left in-house of the support services, but the facilities management bit is going to Mighty. And Interserver, actually, in exchange, they're not completely getting out of Interserver, at the end of all of this, will have a 23.4% shareholding in Mighty. So Interserver will be Mighty's biggest shareholder. But one imagines that it will seek to pay that down. Interserver is not selling its facilities management to Mighty because it wants to be part of a bigger facilities management company. It wants cash to pay off its debt. Yeah. And the banks and financial companies that took over Interserver last year in exchange for their debt to equity deal. They want their money back.
You mentioned in your online news story yesterday, or a couple of days ago, Phil, when this story broke, that Citizen Services, the sort of Interserve healthcare, learning and employment, and probation service work. You said that Interserve has held on to that, but not because it particularly wanted to hold on to it. It's because Mighty didn't want it.
Yeah.
What's all that about?
Well, it doesn't really fit. Facilities management is a bit of a catch-all term. And it's interesting, in the respective statements that Interserve and Mighty put out discussing this deal, Mighty said that it was buying Interserve support services. Hang on, I'm not sure I've got this right. But one of the companies talked about is Interserve support services, and the other organisation talked about Interserve facilities management. That's right. Mighty says it's buying its support services, and Interserve says, no, it's only the facilities management bit. And they were quite specific, Interserve people, quite specific. The facilities management doesn't include, for example, they've got a bit where they are involved with probation service, the care and rehabilitation of offenders, which was privatised by the Ministry of Justice a couple of years ago. But all of those contracts, that was Failing Grayling, who made a hash of... just about every job he's done, it seems. Oh, poor man. He didn't do terrible at transport, and he privatised the probation service, and that's all being nationalised now from next year, and the contracts expire. So Interserve's contracts on that side are running to an end anyway next year.
Right, OK.
So there's no point Mighty paying money for something that's just got a few months left to run. And they've got another business where they're healthcare, which is... not healthcare that you might get the doctors for, but much more the care home assistance, looking after vulnerable and people in special care needs and so on, which is about as far away from construction as I can imagine. But anyway, they're still got that. There's no reason, you've got Interserve now, a construction company. It seems to be doing quite well as a construction company at the moment now. Interserve, it seems to be picking up road building jobs and all sorts of things that you haven't been associated with for a long time. And IMD Quickform still there and still doing well. And so there's no way that Citizen Services, this rump of support service stuff that's with Interserve, It doesn't. I mean, Interserve quite rightly make all the right noises that we're going to, nurture and cherish and run it really well and make a really good go of it. Of course they are, but they'd love someone to take it off their hands.
I think it's interesting because it depends upon your perspective, because you and I probably have always thought of Interserve as being a construction company because we can still remember when it was Tilbury Douglas. And yet when it got into trouble last year and was in the news on a regular basis, it was always described as a services company. And if you read your local national newspaper about stories that Interserve was in trouble, you'd never have realised that it was a construction company or had been a construction company. It seemed that it had really positioned itself. I mean, the change of name to Interserve was deliberate to position itself as a services company, and that was a done deal. It was a services company by the time it got into trouble last year, and only people like you and I actually thought, well, it still builds things, but only just. But so this movement, this move to sell its services division to Mighty, which has always been in facilities management and services, seems to us to be, well, seems to me certainly to be a logical move and a return to its roots.
Exactly that. Well, I think there are an awful lot of trite cliche sayings in business, but they all make a lot of sense. The one I hate but absolutely stand by at the same time is turnover is vanity and profit is sanity.
Which is
but absolutely true. And the other one which I hate but absolutely stand by is sticking to your knitting. I think if you have a role or a job and that's what you do it. And the desire to diversify or chase the easy buck or whatever leads too many people down wrong alleys. I mean, it's not just Interserv and Carillion who've done this. I mean, we've seen many contractors have, to a greater or lesser extent, gone down the facilities management route for different reasons, whether it's through, you know, Kier buying May Gurney and finding it's got bin rounds and emptying bins, or, you know, Balfour Beatty doing these sort of DBFO-type contracts where it's got to look after buildings for 30 years because it's built them, or Wilmot Dixon or others. They've all had at least a toe, sometimes a foot, and sometimes even two legs in facilities management. And they're all, to a greater or less extent, retreating and becoming clearly construction companies once again.
Yes.
And so construction is back in fashion, which I really like.
Yeah, well, that's good. That's good for us. There's another homily that you haven't used, which is that the cobbler should stick to his last.
Yes.
That's another nice phrase that you might have used, but at least that you might have said that turnover is vanity and profit is sanity, and it might have grated, but at least you haven't said anything about the new normal. So I'm very grateful for that.
Won't go there. Won't go there.
No. Excellent. That's probably enough chat for this week, and we've covered quite a lot of ground. So I think we'll sign off now, unless you've got anything else to say just before we go.
Well, I have, apparently, I'm told I have an apology to make to our listeners.
Ooh.
We've had an email from Bryce Bozier, an electronics engineer at JCB, who tells me that he likes your pronunciation of a particular, I'm not even going to try and say it, of a particular material that we talked about last week in the context of some magic paint. But apparently, I can't pronounce it. What's the word I can't pronounce, David?
The word you can't pronounce, Phil, is titanium.
It's apparently which I
is
said
a metallic element.
Apparently, I said titanium.
Yeah, which is very American. We don't do that.
Well, it's the annoying thing. I've learnt recently not to criticise someone for mispronunciation or incorrectly pronouncing something, because what it means, the theory goes, if someone mispronounces a word, it's because they've read it rather than heard it, which makes them intelligent.
Oh, right.
Because if you use a long word and you can't pronounce it, you've read it. That makes you intelligent if you're a reader. But with a word like titanium, if you pronounce it as titanium, it's not because you've read it. Probably it's probably because you've been listening to some crap American pop song. Which
possibly
is,
I don't know. I wouldn't know, Phil.
Which is what Bryce says I'm guilty of.
Oh dear.
And he's probably right. So apologies for saying I will never make a tight of myself again by saying titanium. I'll do more homework.
Okay, well, I think that's probably a good note to end on. Obviously, if anybody else has any criticisms or comments or even compliments to pay, any suggestions about topics we might talk about, we'd very much like to hear about them.
The address, if anyone wants to give us their feedback, podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. Subscribe in all the usual places. Leave us a review, tell people, and stay safe.
Bye for now.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing. We're currently offering a massive 80% discount on subscriptions to the Construction Index magazine. Order yours online today for only £1 per issue. Visit theconstructionindex.co.uk/magazine to subscribe.